listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. A pleasure to welcome you here for this special evening devoted to the Tonight we will explore an exploration. We will explore an exploration. We really will. A, quote, heroic foray into the unknowable, which is one way that Jonathan Lethem describes the magnificent final work of the author Philip K. Dick, which he co-edited with Pamela Jackson. I know many of you, if not most of you, are already fans of Philip K. Dick, and you will have a chance to ask our distinguished panelists your questions. And for those of you who are perhaps meeting Philip K. Dick for the first time, our panelists tonight are probably the best guides you could have to this abridged masterwork, which is based on thousands of pages of typed and handwritten notes, journal entries, letters, and story sketches. Philip K. Dick, who died in 1982, published 36 science fiction novels and 121 short stories over a three-decade writing career. 11 novels and short stories have been adapted to film, notably Blade Runner, based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Total Recall, Minority Report, and A Scanner Darkly. So with us tonight, we have Jonathan Lethem, critically acclaimed author of 8 novels, including Motherless Brooklyn and his latest, Chronic City. Pamela Jackson is an independent scholar, editor, and archivist. Her 1999 dissertation, The World Philip K. Dick Made, initiated a decade study of Dick's exegesis. She is also a graduate of Berkeley High School. Let's hear it for Berkeley High School, which is Philip K. Dick's only alma mater. Laura Leslie is with us tonight. She's the oldest of Philip K. Dick's 3 children. She's been responsible for her father's estate since his death in 1982, and she works closely with her sister, Isa Dick Hackett, who was unable to join us tonight, to steward the legacy of their late father. We have a surprise panelist tonight. We've drafted on the spot. I want to thank Steve Erickson, who is the editor of Black Clock, a wonderful literary magazine. Steve teaches at CalArts, and his new novel, These Dreams of You, comes out in February, and he'll actually be speaking here at Aloud with novelist Percival Everett, so don't miss that. He also wrote the cover story for LA Weekly in 1990 on Philip K. Dick, which, as Jonathan Lethem has said, was a beacon in the darkness of Philip K. Dick studies at the time. We're very glad he could join us. And moderating the panel tonight, we have David L. Ulan, a book critic for the Los Angeles Times, who is the author of 2 award-winning books and as well. As I said, the book critic, and from 2005 to 2010, he served as the Times book editors. His essays and criticism are widely published. He teaches in various educational institutions around town, and this is a doubleheader week for David as he's interviewing Joan Didion for us Wednesday night, so Welcome. We thank him.
Okay, so we're going to talk for a while. I think, as Louise mentioned, we'll turn it over to you guys. I will just simply reiterate the please make the questions. Comment, it's always useful. And I want to start, I think we're going to start with Jonathan, sort of to as a kind of context setter, in terms of both the exegesis, which is this, you've got the dust jacket, so you can display, and also sort of the career and how this sort of fits into both the work and I think the personality of,
sure.
of Philip.
Sure, it's a tall order, and I'll just try to set a few parameters. Yeah. Philip K. Dick is someone who I've made my own career around emulating and celebrating, and I've written about him in several places. For me personally, it was a very simple discovery. I was introduced to paperback science fiction by my mom when I was 11 or 12 with, iRobot and the Martian Chronicles. And in pretty short order, I got interested in the hard stuff, not the what science fiction critics would call the hard stuff, which is very, you know, kind of cosmic, galactic, scientific stuff. But actually, I like the science fiction that was being presented in the mid-70s, which is when I was a teenager, with the kind of druggy-looking covers. And so that was really easy route. At the time, three or four of Dick's best books had just been reprinted by Bantam, Ubik and Maze of Death, Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, and I guess it was those three. And it was also right around the time, in the same couple of years, that A Scanner Darkly was published for the first time. Well, these books changed my life, and anyone who's read them might have the same feeling, and I've now had the privilege of, you know, talking about them and even becoming kind of their editor when they moved into the Library of America. All four of those titles are part of the three volumes that they did on his work. Dick was a quintessential outlaw literary figure. He was not only a kind of dissident within the 20th century literary canon, he was even a dissident within the margin that he found for himself, because science fiction didn't exactly know what to do with him. His energies were provocative and exciting and then disturbing, and eventually he sort of wrote himself out of that field and into, a counterculture legend. But he also, was a very inconsistent writer, living a very difficult life, working sometimes for very credible publishers, sometimes for very ignominious ones. He wrote a lot of novels that he never got to revise, or that he barely finished to his satisfaction, and they were sort of slapped into print. And so it wasn't until after he died in 82 that people began to sort through this really sort of chaotic career, which produced over, Laura, you may know the number, is it over 45 novels in total?
12 realist and 36 science fiction novels.
So nearly 50 novels.
And there were years where he was publishing and writing 7-8 novels.
Yes, and some of the, in 1964, the year I was born, and while he was living with your mom in if I've got this right, in Marin, I think he wrote 6 novels that year, including at least three that are really among his masterpieces, and then some others. I mean, so that's the kind of hyperactive, graphomaniacal output that this guy was capable of. And then it was also it also came to light that near the end of his life, not only had he been talking and writing in his final three novels about visionary experiences, he'd also been writing a kind of unprecedented torrent of material describing this stuff.
And just to interrupt, the last three novels, the trilogy, really does focus on this stuff, but also there's Radio Free Albemuth, which came out after he died.
Right.
And there's other books in Scanner Darkly he touches, there's one passage where he sort of describes it. So it filtered through a lot of other work as well, right? It was sort of a constant presence in the last eight years of his life.
Yeah, well, I'm backing into this slightly, but the date on the spine of this book, 2374, represents the months of February and March of 1974. And it was then that he felt he'd been particularly recipient of a revelatory vision. And it transformed the overt subject matter in his work. He wrote, as David points out, more than three novels, though at the time it appeared there were principally three that centered on this material explicitly. And anyone who knew him and anyone who was a recipient of his letters in that period was also made aware of how this revelation, this mysterious series of experiences, thoughts, hallucinations, you can give them all sorts of names, and he did himself give them all sorts of names, how much they had become a fixation. And he was writing all through it, writing for himself, writing to understand, writing to try to encircle these insights in language, because he was a writer and because he was that kind of driven intellect. He was also researching and surrounding the things he'd experienced or intuited or thought with scholarly points of reference, trying to get a fix on them in the history of theology or philosophy or mysticism. Anyway, so this this enormous cache of materials, even in the period, and you know, we mentioned in, you heard in the introduction, Steve Erickson wrote this marvelous cover story for the LA Weekly in 1990, and that was right around the period that this, well, terrific thing was happening, where almost completely out of print writer who had been mostly ignominiously published in his life, or anyway haphazardly published during his life, crept back into print almost in full, and slowly but surely has taken his place as one of the 20th century's greatest, you know, American writers. I think he's recognized that at, you know, in that sense, both within academic studies and literary criticism, and in a popular sense. He's someone whose name comes readily to the lips of, for instance, my writing students who are in their you know, their teens and 20s. They've heard about him from people who read stuff that they like, and they've read him, and they're excited. He's just, he's really saturated into literary culture now in a way that's, you know, you can only find one or two examples of people, dark horses, becoming so canonical in such a splendid way. Alongside that now, there's been this exploration made possible. I think I'll let someone else sort of narrate from here a little bit. Maybe Laura can tell you. I'll just say that the last bit of this is just a personal couple of remarks. So, I got involved in 85, I think, and 86 with handling some of the posthumous papers. I was working with a man named Paul Williams, a very important music writer and confidant of Dick's, and someone who wrote a very important article about Dick for Rolling Stone in the 70s while Dick was still alive, and who'd been entrusted for a while with kind of managing the posthumous career. And he did it in a very, for Paul, typically eccentric and grassroots fashion. He started a fanzine, basically, and I helped him with the fanzine. And this also, you know, became a intersection where people who were interested in his career at that point, academics or fans or collectors, could come and talk to each other and kind of keep the flame lit during that dark phase. And it was in that time that a few of the mainstream novels that had never been published were finally edited and brought to light. And the first rumblings, what became this explosion, were felt. And in that capacity, I would sometimes be shown a glimpse by Paul of this very mysterious, enormous cache of mostly handwritten papers called the Exegesis, which were living in Sonoma in Paul's garage while everyone scratched their head over what they meant and what to make of them and whether they had any future besides being just kind of a extraordinarily remarkable piece of, you know, leavings by this writer. But there was no clear prospect for them at the time, and I would sort of look at them, and I wasn't sure what I thought. You know, I had no idea, no intimation that I'd become so involved with them as I have. I you know, in some ways, I felt really apprehensive, the way some other fan of Dick might feel today, thinking, well, wait, he's a great novelist, or he's a great science fiction writer, but I don't really want him to be a mystic. I don't want to deal with that. And I had some of those same inhibitions myself. I wasn't attracted initially to the idea that he had visionary experiences and reported them so extensively and so maniacally, really. It was almost a threat to my feeling for this writer. But I have gradually come to expand my sense of, well, what this material consists of and of how large an intellect and how, you know, attractive an intellect Dick was, and how much he can involve me in things that I don't think I want to be involved in. And that's the simplest preface to talking about this editorial project. But Laura, do you want to kind of talk now about...
You know, I did find something that you did in the papers, an analysis of the Zap Gun.
Yes.
Would you like me to give you that?
From the newsletter.
Yeah. So I'm the oldest daughter, and when my father died, he went into a coma on my 22nd birthday, and then passed away 5 days later on March 2nd of 1982. So this has been more than half my life, and I've had the remarkable good fortune to have a wonderful sister and a wonderful brother to work with. Really blessed. Hadn't met my brother but once at my father's house, met my sister when I was 18 at our grandmother's memorial service. So as a personal note, we say this is the best thing for us about Phil K. Dick, because we feel very blessed to have each other. And nobody knows what it's like to be Philip K. Dick's child except the three of us. And I don't say that in a mean way, but it's like even my older sisters, my three older sisters who were much more aware because my father left my mother when I was 3 1/2, they understand some of it, but they don't understand what we consider to be this incredibly important responsibility that sometimes is overwhelming. To do the right thing with the works. And sometimes that's been a journey for us, and it's been a hard thing. I'm not going to put anybody in the spot who's in the audience, but we had an interesting conversation in the escalator, and then I sort of outed myself at the time. But someone said, I think, oh, yeah, we're going to the lecture, and Phil K. Dick was crazy as a loon. Well, that's not an abnormal experience. And that was one of the things that... it was really good. It was a really good thing for me because I can share with you that was probably a tremendous fear that we had as the children of Philip K. Dick, that if this exegesis were published, people would just say he was crazy. When I was in high school, it was all about the drugs and the five ex-wives. And we knew that there was much more to that, and we didn't want that to be his legacy, that he was crazy. Now, on the other hand, you have to know that we also feel very strongly that we don't edit history and we don't take out what we might consider something that we don't like or don't want to know about unless it's somebody who's living and it would hurt them. That's the only thing that we ask you to do is look for things that are personal, that the person is still alive, my mother or Issa's mother, and we feel we have a sense of responsibility to some of the living members of our family. And as part of this journey, and I didn't tell you this before, but when Jonathan really was responsible for our father being in the Library of America, and one of my family said, I think we can now publish the exegesis because there's so much more now, and they won't think he's crazy. And that's a journey for us to come along. My sister's 7 years younger than I am, and my brother's 14 years younger, and we've had to come along in a tremendous journey of maturity and comfort with this legacy, and we really do try to do the right thing. So again, once again, you were sort of a catalyst that you didn't even know about at that time. So next year will be the 30th year from my father's death. And Jonathan came into my life indirectly. My sister is very, very involved in popular culture and the film side of it, and I'm sort of the fact and the business and the back office person, and you never find my picture anywhere, and I'm really happy that people don't know my name, and it's all good for me, and, you know, I had to have 2 glasses of wine to come out here, but here I am. And my sister, I did have one at noon, I didn't tell you. And my sister's not here to hold my hand, which is literally what she's done for me. She literally pulled me out and said, we've got to do some things. We've got to take responsibility. You don't need more active. And I'm like, leave me alone. I'm happy. But so she was telling me one day about all these people, Philippe Starck, you know, these furniture people, the designs for, I'm like, who cares? And then she said, and this guy, Jonathan Levin, this really famous writer, he's got a tattoo of the Ubican. I'm like, that's really weird. But that's how you came into my life. And oddly enough, I read your book, Motherless Brooklyn. Didn't even know you. Loved it. Here Jonathan came. We met. He's like, you know, I think we can get this exegesis published. And we're hearing, nope. It'll break a commercial publisher. Nobody will ever publish it. Nobody will ever publish it. Nobody ever published it. So Jonathan introduced us to Pamela, and we kind of very quietly, and I would say delicately and a little bit dipping our toe in the water, started to talk with Pamela about slowly reading this. And then the next thing is she's got 2 huge boxes of Xerox copies dumped at her house. And she began to read it really patiently with us in the speed that we could go. And then, we kind of had this wonderful convergence of events where we were at the point in time where Jonathan and Pamela could articulate, I guess you know, you're all from Southern California, they could do a take on what the exegesis was in a way that was digestible by a commercial publisher. They could show the vision and what this was. And I will never forget this. We were putting this together to try and show the new publisher, and Jonathan Pamela sent it to me first, and I printed it and read it before my sister printed it and read it, which is pretty unusual because she's way faster than I am. But I called her on the phone. I go, oh, my God, you won't believe this. Let me read you the chapter titles. This is incredible. I get it. And we were, like, literally very emotional because we felt that it was accessible. It was in a way that people could enter this world, and it was something that would be very compelling, and we hadn't been able to do that before. If you looked at 92 folders, and there was only 91 that were filled because a folder was incorrectly included that wasn't part of the exegesis, if you picked any one of these 92 folders in two file drawers and read it, it's very hard to dive into it. That's not the way that you would do it. So I think that what Pamela and Jonathan have done is a wonderful way of bringing this forward through a lot of roadblocks that were put in front of us all through the process. And it's pretty miraculous that we're here, is what I will say. Well, so thank you very much.
Pamela, I want to jump and bring you in on this because, I mean, when I first got into Dick's work, he was really like Kilgore Trout. I mean, you know, he was marginally published at all, and this was sort of the legendary kind of backstory, if you will. I mean, you know, no one had ever seen it, the exegesis. Nobody.
No, we were suppressing it. Yeah.
Right. Nobody was going to see it. It was sort of this thing. And I'm curious about sort of how you made your way through it. There was a smaller chunk of it that was published in, I think, the late '90s, but that was edited by Lawrence Sutton, about 300 pages. And you had sort of looked at that, but what was it like to kind of corral this mass and make it, as Laura says, make it accessible or try to make it accessible, to create a point of entry or various points of entry for people to get into it?
Well, it seemed impossible often and for a long time. When I first got the boxes, these 91 folders, they were in numerical order, but the contents were not in any chronological order. I didn't know which came first. I didn't know whether chronology was even going to be meaningful or whether they were all so far within some deep thought process that it didn't matter what came first. I didn't know whether you would want to have very small chunks like in the Lawrence Sutton volume, which I think that was the late 80s. Because I had it when I was writing, yeah. I was writing my dissertation in the 90s. So he plucked out some wonderful, provocative gems from the midst of these 8,000 pages, but there wasn't enough context to really know what was the rest of it like and how did these even fit into, how could you even think about 8,000 pages of this? What must that be like? So I spent a lot of time just trying to get oriented in it.
And what was that, I mean, just to carry further, what was that process of orientation like when you, how did you start to find your way? I mean, because a great part of editing anything like this, whatever it is a shaping mechanism. How did you start to find your way through the material and find a frame for it?
Well, what happened was once I read through it once and put
through all of the pages,
through everything, skimming and reading, and I started trying to figure out a chronology for it based on occasional clues that were most often something like he would say, for 3 years and 4 months, I've been working on this problem and I think I finally have it. Or for 6 years and 5 months, something like that. I'd be, aha, and I would count out the months and put the folder somewhere. And to some extent, I could actually place most of the folders that way. It was surprising. So then I started over from the beginning and started reading what I knew. And surprisingly, this shows how insanely deep in the material I was by now, I could start seeing the story emerge. I could actually see ideas progressing. I could see events that sort of sent his thoughts off in a new direction. Here he published another book, and that made him think in new directions, or here he had another vision. And I keep calling it a story, and people think I'm crazy because there's nothing story-like in reading it. But that's how I made sense of it. I made it into this story of his intellectual journey that had all these little high points along the ways and digressions, but I could see an overall shape to it.
And when you were,
jump in, please.
When you were reading all this material, was there anything that seemed like clearly a beginning?
Yes, because it began with the letters. It began with, in 1974 and 1975, it began with letters primarily to a woman named Claudia Bush, who appeared in his life at just the right moment to receive the full story of what was happening to him as it happened. And so the beginning, the first year, and then it gets more deeper into theoretical exploration, but the first year is largely taking place in letters. And so there...
And it's really him just trying to figure out what it is that he's been experiencing, right?
I mean, yeah, and things are continuing to happen as he writes, so it's where you really are in the midst of this unfolding of these events for a while. And that sense of drama, of the sort of high-speed detective chase of these events definitely falls away once you get into the later exegesis and you're just, you know, making your way through volumes of paper. Well,
but the story in the latter sections, I mean, as you pointed out to me, becomes the story of how the published books of the so-called Vallis trilogy become themselves material, revelatory material. You know, he publishes books and interprets those, and they become a lens to reflect back on the experience.
Right.
So the novels are influencing the exegesis, not the other way around.
Well, both, of course. But he finds himself surprised by how he's articulated things once he moves them into fictional form, and so then he has a new set of metaphors to interpret. You know, it's as if the novels are themselves visions that he's. I mean, which is not exclusive to the Vallis novels. He's also interpreting Ubik and. As you know, a lot of the earlier novels, Eye in the Sky, seems very important to him at one point. And
well, it also seems that a lot of the themes, you know, I mean, in terms of this notion of, his fascination with simulacra and so forth, that there are these themes that he's playing with from the very beginning of his career that are echoed or redeveloped through both the mystical experience, whatever it is, and also through the exegesis, right? I mean, he talks about that too, that these are themes that have been there forever in some sense for his own work.
It's funny, you walked in wearing your Bob Dylan shirt, Stephen. I'm always thinking about this conversation that I get into about Dylan's Christian phase, where, people who are skeptical of it or totally resistant will act as though there's a kind of a quarantine. There's only this little period when he writes biblically influenced lyrics, which is nonsense, of course. He's writing from the Old Testament from the very beginning with When the Ship Comes In and, you know, or there's Sign on the Cross. There are all these extraordinarily developed Old and New Testament motifs in his songwriting before 1979 or whenever it first becomes overt. And in a way, Dick is the same way. He was preparing to be the writer of the exegesis from the very beginning. He hadn't done the research yet. So he only had the equipment of metaphor and sometimes very goofy metaphor to explore these intuitions. But they were already occurring to him, I think, as models of the universe that needed to be accounted for.
I want to get to what this thing is, but first, Steve, I want to ask you. You were one of the writers who came in to sort of annotate certain passages. You're involved in this project also. I want to ask you about how you got involved in it, and also sort of what your participation was like.
Jonathan was kind and generous enough to invite me to be a part of it, and. As I think was mentioned, I had written a fairly big piece about Dick some years earlier, and you know I think as much as anything else, the exegesis gave me an excuse to kind of go back and rediscover all of those things that I had felt about Dick in the beginning, mainly as a writer. You know, that was my response. I didn't have the personal connection that a number of the people here did. It was a purely literary connection. And so I was, and I think that still remains the case. So most of what I had to say, if it has any value at all, it was looking at this as a kind of blueprint for his fiction, and that's why I'm interested to hear that in some ways the fiction was also a blueprint for this, which I didn't anticipate.
Yeah, I love the idea of them kind of feeding off of each other. So I'm going to throw this open to all of you. Jump in, but you know, what is it? I say that as someone who's spent the last several days waiting around in it. So, you know,
I'd love to lean backward, but I think it's Pamela and I who need to lean forward here. Do you want to try first?
You start.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first thing Pamela sort of named is it's a ontological mystery story. He has what feels to him like a experience of rupture of his reality, a complete break with time's passage, with the material world, and with his understanding of his place in the universe. And it's instantaneous and indescribable. And then he spends 8,000 pages trying to describe it. Okay, that's the simplest thing you could say about it. And then, to make matters more difficult, he already was Philip K. Dick. So he had an extremely active metaphor-generating imagination. So he projects systems and stories and models. He tries to project it in four-dimensional time-space. He grabs onto anything he can find to try to affix an explanation to this deep, I'd say, physical sense of revelation that things are not as they seem. And, of course, this connects very powerfully to the kinds of experiences he'd already subjected his characters to for decades.
Well, and also he had basically, by virtue of the kind of fiction he was writing, he had trained himself to doubt all of this as well, so that
right.
Everything that he's everything that's being revealed to him, he automatically is conditioned to doubt.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, his great theme, or one of his great themes in his fiction, is the stripping away of a mask that conceals the deeper reality. And yet he'd already progressed far enough before he had his own experience of having reality's mask stripped away to always doubt the simple answer that what's underneath the mask is therefore real. He'd conceived of complicated, trapdoor theories where the mask was actually realer than what was revealed, or the mask reveals something that is a trap for the person who's the seeker. And so when he had his own mystical revelation, he applied this kind of radical, destabilizing, philosophical paranoia to it that was extremely exciting and disturbing. And, you know, he was in some ways, you know, the sort of quip you could make about this is he became a character in a Philip K. Dick novel, right? And then the rest of the explanation bogs down in biographical specifics, you know, and those are all fascinating too. So what was happening during those years? What other stimuli came along and bent this experience of writing these, you know, metaphysical explanations in different directions? Well, his publishing goes up and down, and Hollywood approaches him and begins talking to him about Blade Runner, and you know he becomes more capable and more content and a little better off towards the end of his life, which affects his thinking very deeply. You know, he begins to analyze that as a possible reward for his mystical journey. You know, that he's reaching some sort of better place in the material world, even as he's doubting its persuasiveness or his hold over him. And, you know, he's the kind of guy who would audition any theory that came his way. So if someone said to him, oh, well, you'd better look into this book that just came out, The Origin of the Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind by Julian Jaynes, which is a very popular work of speculative anthropology that came out in the 70s, arguing that for primitive man, the two hemispheres of the brain were stranded from one another. And so what early writings describe as the voice of the gods was merely the, you know, right hemisphere talking to the left hemisphere, and you would hear voices in your head as a normal matter of course. Well, he thought, oh, you know, for a month or two, he thought, of course, this is what's happened. And so this became the organizing principle. So you see him engulfing philosophy, engulfing theology. He discovers Gnostic Christianity, excuse me, which obviously is extremely fertile. It's very simpatico with a lot of his insights. So he becomes a Gnostic for a while, you know, and in a way he never stopped. That became a very dominant metaphor for what he was thinking about. But he had a brilliant quality of openness. He was a kind of an ultimate autodidact, and very unsnobbish about what where the answer might lie. It could be in the Encyclopedia Britannica. On a lot of days, it was in the Encyclopedia Britannica somewhere, or it might come in the form of like a letter from a fan saying, "I just reread your short story, you know, X from this year, and it seems to me the most profound, you know, work of literature that mankind has ever." And he goes back and reads his own short story, and he thinks, "Well, gee, it was me. You know, maybe I knew already in 1957. That might be it." You know, so he's just always ready to have it explained and to work it out. He takes it through its paces. I'm very interested in hearing Pamela talk about it as a story, because one of the other descriptions that makes it very interesting, of course, made it extraordinarily difficult to edit and make sense of, is that it's a little bit like Groundhog Day. He starts over again. It's not cumulative, except that the impressions of the previous journeys are with him. But basically, he runs an idea or an explanation to its ground, exhausts himself. You can guess probably, you know, sleeps for 15 hours, and then he gets up the next day, often having vowed, forget it, I'm never thinking about this stuff again, and there's a glimmer, and he thinks, wait, this is it, and then it's Groundhog Day again. He starts over. And so it's a constantly it crumbles into ash, and like a phoenix, it rises over and over and over again, as he forswears one theory and replaces it with another.
This is actually one of the things that makes it so hard to read straight through the exegesis, because of this tempo of this manic flow of ideas that doesn't... It starts to get somewhere, and if you're on the journey with him, you're like, yeah, we're getting somewhere. It gets exciting. He's getting excited. And then there's a peak, a crescendo of some kind. He seems to have the answer. And then without any break at all, there's a new paragraph or a new page. And you don't know whether he took a break. Did he sleep on it? Did he take a walk around the house and feel excited that he'd come up with something? But without any obvious break, you're back just in the trenches again. And it's really grueling emotionally and intellectually to go along that with him and to just like... peak after peak, followed by, you know, these exhausting stretches in between, and no point where you can just rest and say, okay, this is the answer, at least for today.
Right, and he was often writing extensive, I mean, you know, you talk about him writing 120 pages in a night, right, or something like that.
Of course, there's no absolute way to verify this, but, you know, Pamela, who is the one getting really intimate with these pages, You see a movement. It seems like an unbroken sequence that goes on for just a jaw-dropping duration, and it either was, an all-nighter, or somehow he was able to, you know, eat a sandwich, take a little break, and come back and pick it up. But it's like they're runs. He's going into the out into the philosophical night and making a run for something, and he chases it, and then it collapses. Yeah, it's heroic and tragic, definitely in equal proportion.
Laura, what was he like during this period? I mean, you know, we only know him from the pages, but you knew him in life.
I'll have to sort of amplify what that really meant. So, what my father left when I was 3 and a half, and to the point in time where he died, I spent in his presence or with him 5 or 7 days total.
Of that whole period?
Yeah, yeah, that whole period. So, what, 18, 19 years. But when I was 12, he wrote me a letter and said, hey, you know, I'm your dad, blah, 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 let's have contact. And I'm like, pound sand, I haven't talked to you in forever, and if you're not going to give me your address, you tell me right, you can take care of your mom, pound sand. Well, and that was great. So he thought that was the greatest thing in the world, that I sort of blew him off. And he kept that letter. I actually have it now. But he was a phenomenal letter writer. And I have a huge binder of letters that he wrote me. And so the relationship really established itself over letters, and he would call at times. It was much easier to interact with him in letters because he had the flu a lot, which was, my sister was great to give me this context. Flu, I have the flu is the code for I can't handle something. I can't deal with something. I can't go out. I have something I'm supposed to do. I can't do it. I have the flu. And she was great in giving me this context and understanding. He didn't talk to me about any of this ever. And my take on it is I think he really wanted me to like him and approve of him. And it was important for him not to be too far out there. And this is just my interpretation. So, you know, I went through, these teen years. And he really never riffed on that kind of stuff to me. But he would send me things that were this review or that review, or I've gotten this award or that award. And so it was a whole different kind of interaction than even he had with anybody else. Right. So I did not know he'd had that experience. I had a heart attack when that Rolling Stone article was in my high school in my freshman year. And so Sandy Davis stands up in the library and screams at the top of her lungs, "Is this your father?" And I made the librarian, Charlotte Karotkin, take it home and say, "Get it out of here." So, you know, that's my experience. So I didn't see this thing. I mean, I had this thing in a hat. I don't have it anymore. I had in a big fireproof safe in my house. And I would go through it and, you know, we'd sit there and try to read things. And it's like, oh, I can't read this. And then I think I typed like 200 pages up from the very beginning. That was really intense. I mean, it's very, very, crap. He didn't, it's very dense. And if you are information dense, you know, it's like, don't eat nuts because they have a lot of calories. Well, Philip K. Dick and his exegesis has a lot of density. But it's very true. And from my knowledge of him, I know he believed everything he wrote, and he was writing it for himself. And so my takeaway from it is everything is incredibly sincere, and everything is he's, you know, you say driven, I say pulled to try and figure out what was going on, and literally pulled forward and could never put it down or put it away. And each of the, see, for you, it's a little bit abstract. For me, when he thinks that Bishop Pike is visiting him, I'm like, holy crap, Bishop Pike is visiting him. This is not good. Bishop Pike, well, you know, I don't know if you know this, Bishop Pike was the Episcopal bishop of San Francisco who was tried for heresy and thrown out of the Episcopal Church, and his son committed suicide, and he was having an affair with somebody in our family. I won't mention any names. But and he went to Israel, and he disappeared in the desert in Israel looking, I don't know if he was what he was looking for. But I mean, these are real people. So this is not an abstraction for me. This is like, okay, I think he thinks Bishop Pike is possessing him. Okay. And then that goes away. As you know, as uncomfortable as that is, then he drops that one. And then it's something that's abstract to me. So I have a different experience with it.
I want to follow this up in a second, but first I want to ask Steve, you were talking earlier about sort of your approach to him was as a literary figure rather than through some of the personal stuff. And I wonder if you can maybe just kind of contextualize for us a little bit what you think of him as a literary figure.
Well, let me make a couple points, if I can, about that are interesting to me about the work. And one of them is the theme of memory that I think actually is an undercurrent in all of his books. There's these three great themes of, you know, what is reality, what is humanity, and what is God. And memory seems to be the thread through all of those questions and whatever answers may come from them. And there's a book of his called We Can Build You, and these scientists they're building an Abraham Lincoln. They're building an Abraham Lincoln robot, and they flip the switch, and this Lincoln robot cries out in pain, and they've created a Lincoln who not only looks like Lincoln, who not only feels like Lincoln and moves and speaks like Lincoln, he remembers like Lincoln, and that and in doing so, he becomes Lincoln. And, you know, we see it in Do Android or Blade Runner, or Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, that these androids who can remember things, that is where the core of their humanity lies. And what's interesting to me about the exegesis is that, you know, Jonathan described it as a rupture. And I think one of the things that ruptures in this book, and it seems to me as a reader, is that ruptures for Dick is memory's meaning. Because you've got this date in, what is it, 1973 or 4, and that kind of cleaves time in two and cleaves memory in two. And he is, one of the revelations for me is he seems to have lost his faith in memory. The other point I would make, quickly, I hope, is that, you know, he... At the beginning of his career, he wrote a dozen books or so that are considered not science fiction. And then there's this other batch of books for which he became famous that are distinguished as science fiction. Those first 12 are considered realistic novels. If you've read them, they're pretty unusual novels. I mean, they're a kind of suburban surrealism that nobody else was writing. You know, if you had taken Cheever from the East Coast and crossed him with Borges, you would have come up with what Dick was doing in the 1950s. And these novels never went anywhere. They didn't take off. And, you know, he was interested in the concerns of genre anyway, but he was also sort of ghettoized into genre because of the failure of these books. I think that some of them are among his best books. Confessions of a Crap Artist, in Milton Lumpke territory, The Man Whose Teeth Were All Exactly Like, if I'm getting that title
yes,
right.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, they're very original, unusual books. But in Confessions of a Crap Artist, you've got a guy who writes the history of the world in 117 pages or something, and he's pulled out all these bits of culture to fill up this history of the world. And it's almost like that could have been the first version of the exegesis. And when he gets to the end of his career and he gets to the end of his life, as his thinking gets more and more far-flung, his fiction starts to curve back to these books that he wrote in the 50s. And this was a guy who had argued again and again that time is round, and his literature was round, and the and books like Scanner Darkly, and particularly I'm blanking the very last one.
Transmigration of Timothy.
Yes, the Transmigration of Timothy Archer. Thank you. You know, he comes back to some of the concerns of the earlier so-called realistic books, even as at the same time he's writing, if you'll forgive me, some of his craziest stuff in the exegesis. By the way, crazy writer is a redundancy.
Okay, so I have one last question, and then I'm going to turn it over to you guys. But this is also for all of you. So we've sort of been talking not exactly talking around, but in a way talking around what exactly the mystical experience was. What do you think happened? What do we think this was? I mean, you could come up with any number of explanations for it, beginning with the fact that it was a legitimate mystical experience, and ending with the fact that it was somehow chemical or emotional or whatever. What do you guys think happened? What do you think it was?
Are you looking at me?
Pamela, do you want to?
There are so many possible explanations for this, and we wrote about a little bit about this in the introduction. It's been speculated since the earliest and most common speculation was that it was temporal lobe epilepsy, and yet. Once you look into his history and also read more of the exegesis and find these, you know, little ruptures within it of further visions and things, it doesn't seem necessary to say that was there. He's also clearly manic depressive. I mean, I don't know whether. I'm not trying to make a clinical diagnosis,
it's okay.
But
I'm pretty sure you're right.
I became fairly certain that he was having a series of small strokes and that he did die of a stroke in the end. So we don't know. But I think whatever it was also a legitimate mystical experience. And beyond that, I don't know.
I'll just add to some of Pamela's remarks a little bit and say I use a term I like very much, that anyone looking for an explanation is spoiled for choice. It's not that it's a question of what could have done this. It's a question of which of innumerable things could have sparked it. And because of the likelihood of neurological damage because of his use of pharmaceuticals, because of...
Really pretty much limited to just amphetamines.
Amphetamines,
let's be careful about it.
I say pharmaceuticals because that, you know, it was amphetamines. It was right. It was a very 1950s kind of drug use. And because of his ill health and, you know, the destination, as Pamela says, is he was to die of a stroke. You can surround this with all sorts of guesses, and yet they don't really help you think about why this book exists, you know? So when Pamela says a legitimate mystical experience, I think what she means is that the question isn't what, what neurological or physiological or emotional precursor might have been present. It could have been a whole bunch of them, or none of the ones that we've ever glanced at, right? The question is, how does that become this? How does that become an inquiry into the nature of existence that has the qualities that it does and is so extraordinarily perplexing, even to its author? And I mean, I think that one of the most important descriptions, and I owe this to Pamela as well, is that the exegesis becomes about consciousness and about writing specifically. It is an exploration of what it is to try to apply language to the problem of our existences, you know, to the permanent mystery of being, brains in bodies in space in relation to time and memory and other brains in space. These are things that any number of people have gone at, and this writer goes at it throughout his life through the methodology of narrative and metaphor and, allegory, essentially. I mean, if you think about his work, in some ways it's like a gigantic pile of allegories for ontological mystery. Well, and then at the end of his life, he goes at it with raw language. He strips away narrative, he strips away allegory, strips away metaphor. Of course, those things do creep back in. They can't help but do so because our brains generate those things very typically, and his did very brilliantly. But he tried to go at it, you know, mano a mano. Okay, no more stories, just me and the universe. And he just tried and tried and tried with a power and a you know, audacity that's just, you know, staggering. what is your estimate of how many, what percentage of the pages are represented in this fat, impossible book we've put together?
Well, first I thought it was 1 out of 10, and then I thought, well, it's probably 1 out of 8 or 1 out of 7. And I couldn't decide, but
so if you think this percentage is bad, we were gentle with you, okay, dear reader. This is mercy right here.
I think the answer is it doesn't really matter what the source of his experience was, and I think, having grown older and inherited his health profile among his children, I think he had uncontrolled high blood pressure. We're very certain that we know why. Couldn't control it with blood pressure medicine, and the numbers were pretty staggering when you read them. And he wasn't exaggerating, although he was a tremendous exaggerator. I think that these were accurate numbers. So, you know, that's on the heavy side. My sister and I, we constantly talk about this, and we go, wouldn't you have gone to the doctor if you had that experience? So there's this, like, well, I mean, I would have thought something was wrong with me, but there's an interesting sort of arrogance that I get out of it, and it tickles me. It's not a bad sort of arrogance. It's this wonderful sort of arrogance that, hey, God's visiting me. I'm like, are you kidding me? God is visiting you? Oh, I would never assume it was God visiting me. I'm just being honest.
No, we had talked a little bit about possibly reading a small section. You want to do a quick section something just to give you guys a taste before we turn it up?
Okay, I've got two paragraphs I grabbed onto that. One, just, you know, one of the things we haven't touched on at all is politics here, and I know it's the source of some of the most stirring moments. Well, in Dick's work overall is quite political, and some of Steve's annotations, you know, are brilliant reminders. Well, this is 1974. What's going on? The American political system was cleaved into. Our belief in the continuity of the American concept, you know, fell apart, and a horrible system of lies was brought into visibility, right, with the Watergate scandals. And you know, this was a major preoccupation for Dick. He'd vilified Nixon for quite a while before being, in a sense, you know, vindicated more than he might have ever dreamed by this revelation.
Oh,
but
yeah,
anyway,
if I ever have to transcribe another letter to the committee on blah 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 blah, every single one, it's like, wow.
So anyway, we, among the many things we could have talked about, we didn't really get to yet. Is politics. I was just reading this, and one of the most beautiful metaphors in the whole exegesis is actually comes from the world of baseball. Sort of, he says that God looks for balking as a criterion. The idea that that moment when you just step off the mound, when something's wrong, and you just can't do what you're supposed to do. The script is not tolerable. And so this word balking comes into this paragraph, which I spotted, and I thought, here he is predicting the Occupy Wall Street movement beautifully. In February of 1974, I momentarily withdrew assent to the reality of this world. A month later, this world underwent visible changes, and its true nature became perceptible to me. It is, as the Gnostics say, a prism. It is there, but it is not as it appears to be. The immediate reaction to the anomie in the world is to say simply that it is out of control. If it is there to reawaken us to our divine origins, however, its malign aspects serve a good purpose. What each of us must do is repudiate the world, which is to say, deny it, while at the same time affirming a sanctified alternate reality, which I did. It was a single act, a movement away from the first to the second. I think I figured out the basic movement necessary, an ethical balking. That is how the world denying begins. That is the first step in unraveling the counterfeit quality of the world. The Gnostics stressed such a metaphysical strike and pointed out that the archons who rule this prison world, the wardens, can only harm the body and mind, but not the divine spark. It is a refusal to cooperate with a harmful world, which, once one has balked against it, reveals its ersatz quality. I mean, that just sounds like everything that's right about what's happening in the streets right now, is the refusal to even speak on their terms. What is your demand? Undemand. No demand. Just, we're not doing this anymore. So,
the one... We were a little worried that we'd be starting a new religion with this. He really didn't like L. Ron Hubbard and didn't have any respect for him whatsoever. Like,
bad science
fiction
writer.
Well, what do you
think?
You think this will be a new religion? I don't know. What do you think? So, there's a little fear there, too, but...
Don't worry.
We have a pretty good imagination.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to do that.
Good.
Okay, this is...
All right, let's...
That's good. I think we should get to questions.
We've got some microphones, so if you guys raise your hands, someone will bring them around. And if you don't raise your hands, we'll do it for you.
Hi. Is it on? I was really interested in something that, Jonathan, you started talking about, Philip, being an autodidact or this kind of an autodidact, maybe. And I was wondering if you could talk a little more about, or anyone really, about any insight you might have had as far as what is the relationship between that autodidacticism and his, well, this word really didn't come up on the panel, but epiphany, if there is an epiphany in there?
I can try, Pamela is a person who more closely than I did charted the entry of his, on the ground researching into the flow of ideas from sources into the exegesis, and his appetite for scholarship, wherever he could find it, and he'd cannibalize any body of knowledge and of course cannibalize his own earlier works. He was a very literate person, but in a very scattershot, interesting way, typical of some writers, many writers. I mean, I identify with it. I'm like my hero. I'm a dropout from college, and the more important education was the one I kind of invented for myself. So it's moving to me to see people working on the ground that way. Eric Davis, who, like Steve, was one of our annotators, but a very important annotator. He kind of edited all the annotations and is was a secret hero of this whole project, coined the term garage philosopher for Dick, which really fits nicely. He would use any resource he needed to amp up the thinking he was doing, and that offered him a kind of freedom from frameworks. He wasn't working from inside canonical or hierarchical structures of how knowledge should be acquired, and so certainly, accounts for both the inconsistencies and incongruities, but also the wild leaps of insight and associational insight between different bodies of knowledge that you encounter in this writing.
And it allowed him to have his the quest be uppermost, so he didn't worry about mastering, whether he actually understood Heidegger or Spinoza or any of these things. He was looking for the insight that he could grab from that and the connection that he could make to something else. And this is one of the things that was really fascinating to me, is how you could see how the autodidact does his work here, and it's so different from other modes of scholarship, because it's so directed by need, by what his need to know, and not any concern with...
It was the daily bread of the work, was to find something that chimed with it and could reorient his effort. Thanks.
Hello? Oh, okay. Hi. I was just curious. Not too long ago, Carl Jung's Red Book was released in sort of mass market splendor. And it's very interesting thing in that it goes through, it was like a heavily illuminated manuscript where he goes through all of his early beliefs and sort of the founding of his method of analysis. And I'm wondering if you believe that the exegesis would be a decent bedside companion to that book. And also, is it true that during his lifetime, Philip K. Dick was never able to option a story or a book into a movie, and that caused him a lot of anger before he passed away? I'm just curious.
Second part, no. First part, you can answer. Before he died, he had optioned Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the short story Second Variety, and the short story We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. So, but for $10,000, $40,000, and $10,000, straight up, straight out. All, everything to the people who optioned it, and he was very excited about all of those. That was a lot of money. And the first part, I don't know.
Now I can't remember the first
part. Is it a good bedside companion?
Oh, yeah, I haven't spent time with Jung's Red Book. I'd like to... I have an impression that in some way it was a more I don't know why I'm saying this, because it's really a guess, that it was a more calculated presentational secret book, that it was sort of there to be uncovered, whereas Dick's had to be created. I mean, I think editorially the greater resemblance, although it's also a very spurious comparison in some ways, was to the novel, quote-unquote novel, Left Behind by David Foster Wallace, The Pale King, where something had to be, the editor editor or editors had to make the, find the book inside the papers. I think Jung's thing was quite, wasn't it quite complete, and they published the entirety, right? Yeah. But I do guess that Jung's book and this, if they were put on either side of a bed, would lead to some very interesting cross pillow talk. Yeah.
Hi, this is for the daughter, I guess, a question. The Polish writer Stanisław Lem and your father once had a famous, I suppose, incident where Lem praised him, and I guess your dad attacked him.
Attacked him?
Well, attacked him Lem praised his work as being very original and fascinating and so forth and so on. And as far, I've read that your dad reported him to the FBI as a communist threat. And blah,
yep.
Blah, blah. And so, it seems fair to say there's a little paranoia there. But
yep.
Anyway, they both passed on, and I was wondering, since Lem's family, and specifically his son, also is interested in furthering his legacy, if you've ever had some sort of rapprochement with the family or had any involvement with furthering both their great legacies as authors.
No, but that's a really interesting idea. I hadn't thought about it. I haven't thought about it, but my take on that whole thing, my dad had a very blue-collar attitude toward money. He worked really hard, and money was a really big deal to him. Not the accumulation of money, but I think the value that money ascribed to his hard work. And that falling out was because he believed, whether it's true or not, that he wasn't being paid properly, that the money was in Poland, and he had to go get it in Szlotskis, or I'm not sure what the Polish dollars are. Please forgive me. And yes, he was a little paranoid. But it was a falling out over my dad's perception of not being paid, and he kind of attributed that to Lem unfairly. And he sent more than one person to the FBI.
Hi. Steve touched on it briefly, but I wonder if someone else also could talk about the Transmigration book, because it's less... perhaps on the surface, less obviously related to the events of March 74, but clearly Dick thought so. And I wondered, Pamela or Jonathan, as you went through the material and the exegesis, was there something there that stood out for you that maybe there was the source of the story idea?
Well, you know that's Bishop Pike. Right. Yeah.
So his very first, in the early stuff material that I was transcribing in the early, where he was writing to himself, not in the letters, he didn't share this to anybody in the letters, and it, correct me if I'm wrong, one of his first theories was that he was being possessed by Jim Pike. And so to me, that's the linkage, but I'm sure there's a literary linkage that is not, it's not something that I really understand, probably.
Well, one thing that book was about was, and one way it was about the exegesis, was it was about making the choice to do crazy sort of adventures in your mind and go out into the desert and look for God versus commitment to your home, your family, your community. And I think that that's a really beautiful final book for him to have written, although he didn't intend it to be his last, because the answer that he comes to there. And he himself, he loved Angel Archer. He just was amazed that she had come to him. And there's
the character who narrates this book.
Yeah. As a kind of redeeming creation of his. And this is one of my favorite parts of the exegesis, is his meditations on the transmigration.
Yeah.
And Angel Archer.
Yeah. It's as though the book offers him a solace that he can't, attain in daily life, because it's in a sense a vision of renouncing the exegesis work. It's a novel of character that speculates on what it would feel like if he could let it go.
We have one over there.
I think this might be for Jonathan. You mentioned how the process of the exegesis was heroic but also tragic. And from what I've read from people who knew him at the time, this is a very joyful thing for him. Like, he would just spill out all these ideas. And, you know, it seemed, they said there's this idea of him as this, like, you know, which has come up tonight, this crazed lunatic possessed by the force of what he's doing. But really, it was a very positive thing for him. So I want to ask you, what do you feel is the tragic aspect of the exegesis?
Well, when I use that word, I don't really mean in any encompassing sense. But I think in miniature, And it's borne out in sequence after sequence, there are tremendous highs and lows in the experience of questing the way he was doing, questing into his own intuitions about the universe and his own dread of what the answers might, what implications they might have, what kind of judgment he might encounter. But I also think in a physical sense, there are valleys of exhaustion and demoralization that he encounters in failing to crack the code, failing to, you know, culminate the thinking, the kinds of dead ends or dead stops that Pamela was describing. And there are a few moments where you see him renouncing this work and cursing it, calling it a hell chore. That was the term that was so striking. And of course, Pamela was constantly telling me that, you know, she'd inherited the hell chore. I don't think that sense of emotional, the dark nights of the soul can be written out of this story. I think they're part of it, and the dialectic, the emotional dynamic is one of the dramas that's most enthralling in reading it.
Well, I've just been given the high sign, so I'd like to thank the panelists and thank you guys. Go buy books.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.